there. I hope you're all doing well today. Whether you're in lockdown in Da Nang or are able to participate in what I call legal walking, again here in Hoi An, Vietnam. Now, there's a story behind that term. You'd have to check out my Facebook page for more information on my run-in with the law recently in Hoi An. I'd like to welcome you to this final episode of this season on A Lust for Sober Life podcast with me, Mr. Terrapod. It's been a busy 8 months podcasting and working on various projects. I'll speak a little bit more about the year that has been and future plans at the end. My guest today is Johan Falk, a local MC, presenter, performer, actor, and drama teacher, among many other things. Johan is a friend. He is a man that I have huge respect and admiration for. His service, passion for, and commitment to the arts this last 19 years, both in his home country of South Africa and here in Vietnam, is simply astonishing. He's a real jack of all trades, and it would take me a podcast alone just to name out some of his achievements to date. His professional debut came in 2002 at the age of 15 in the highly successful production Anna Candiat, which achieved nationwide acclaim during 39 performances. At heart though, Johan is an actor, and this remains his true love. We will touch on this theme in the podcast. Johan recently spoke on the Comeback podcast with Connor Kelly about his career in much greater detail, and I encourage you to go back and listen to that podcast as well. The Johan we hear today is of the raw, frustrated artist ilk. He shoots straight from the hip on a range of issues and unloads some of the frustrations that are troubling him. These are probably exacerbated by being in a strict lockdown this last 6 weeks here in Da Nang. It is clear that Johan is a very humble man. He finds himself at a similar crossroads in his life here in 2021 that he experienced back in South Africa in 2015. There are many similarities that we discuss. I put it to Johan that he may be experiencing what I term as pre-mourning. Perhaps he is mourning the life that he was building in Da Nang that he may be leaving behind. It's definitely drastically changing. This is a very emotive podcast at times, and I let Johan free off the reins, so to speak, to unload. It's raw, it's authentic, it's honest, it's powerful. That's why I really like speaking to Johan. He's bullshit free. I learned a lot during this podcast, like I do with every podcast. I hope you enjoy it. With Mr. Terrapod, you are not alone. Johan Falk, welcome to A Lust for Sober Life podcast. It's a real honor to have you on the show today on what is the last episode of the season, actually. How are you and how is life in lockdown Da Nang?
Oh, that's sad to hear that it's the last for a while. You've done so well with your podcast. It's amazing, amazing stories. Congratulations. It's really a purposeful, meaningful thing you've been going on about. It's awesome.
Thank you very much, Johan. You're too kind.
How's life in Da Nang? Well, you know, how good can it get when you're not even allowed to do your own shopping?
Listen, some people like you need to be kept indoors, Mr. Falk.
Yeah, I mean, life's a roller coaster. You know, you get your ups, you get your downs, and every situation is an opportunity to learn and to evolve and to try and take the challenge and hopefully come out stronger the other side. And this is just one massive one for the global consciousness movement, you know, it's a big one.
So tell us, Johan, what have you learned during this period?
Well, we're on a podcast right now, so you tend to kind of speak to a wider audience, and you want to talk about things that are more relatable. You don't want to be too personal, but obviously everyone has their personal challenges. And oh my gosh, man, what a, like I said, it's a roller coaster because I've been through quite a few severe changes in the last 2 years, like everyone else, and on a personal level, on an emotional level, you know, on relationship level. And if you're going to have to talk about the good, you have to talk about the bad, you know, like whenever you interview people or when you make those posts about me on Facebook and like hyping it up and making me sound like I've achieved so much, I'm like, whoa, man, like, let's be honest here, you know, the world needs transparency. All this Instagram world that we created does not exist. You are not your social media, and you're not your resume. You are not your biography. You know, the real life, the real struggle, or the real challenges are the ones within. And I think you know that.
Absolutely, Johan. Well said. You know, when I started podcasting in Da Nang back in February, I compiled a list of people I'd like to talk to. And believe it or not, your name was nearly top of that list. Because, you know, I'm also a big fan of the arts, mate, and I saw the work you were doing in the local community here in Da Nang. And then later I read your profile on Da Nang 101. I was amazed by what you had achieved in South Africa before coming to Vietnam in 2015. So I guess where I'd like to start with your story today is right back as that teenage boy in Robertson in the Western Cape of South Africa. You know, it's an area, Johan, I've spent a little time around myself, having visited Cape Town and Franschhoek a couple of times. You definitely come from a beautiful part of the world, and like a lot of young South Africans, I guess, you grew up dreaming of becoming a Springbok, but a very serious injury in your teenage years ended that dream, which in turn led to severe depression. So I'd like to take you back to that moment in your life, if you don't mind. And if you would, can you please share with us how you reacted to that news, and how did the ending of that dream eventually lead you towards acting?
I want to take it a few steps back, actually. So let me tell you my journey with rugby, actually. Like, I grew up pretty liberal. When I was small, my parents were still students. They're totally self-made people, you know. And I had these long hair. I looked like a girl when I was small. So I got bullied often. And when I started playing rugby, that was the first time I started kind of like enjoying my masculinity in a way, you know, as much as you can enjoy at the age of 7. So for me, the whole journey with rugby or playing that sport was, it's kind of like an escapism. It's kind of like, you know, an identity you can put on without having to deal with your fragility, if I almost want to say it like that. So when it got taken away from me eventually, because I did do well in it, I was Kramer Week captain, and I really excelled in that sport. I was really serious about it, and I sucked in everything else, except for maybe public speaking and drama and things like that, but I wasn't an academic at all. So by the time that got taken away from me, I had no idea what was going to happen. I mean, I was 14, 15 years old. My whole identity, my whole life was based on the sport and my status as this sport guy, you know. And when it got taken away from me, and it happens to a lot of sportsmen, it just happened really early on in my career, and it's actually a blessing in disguise, because if that never happened, my eyes would have never opened to the world beyond a little sports tour with the boys.
You mentioned escapism in there, Johan. What exactly was it that you were escaping from?
Sport in general is a remarkable thing. It's a lovely thing. I love sport. Sport unites, and our country invests a lot in sport, especially rugby and cricket and those things, because it kind of creates, you know, union and unity and pride and things like that. For me, it was a way of socializing, I guess. I mean, growing up in the countryside, like that's kind of what you do. You're outside, you're in the trees, you're with the, you know, like when somebody's got a ball, they've got some friends, that's how you play. But it created, I think sports are important also because it teaches people how to be competitive, but in a playful way, if you know what I mean. And it also kind of It teaches you that team sports, there's no I in team, if you know what I mean. Like that whole thing, you know, it's all about achieving a goal together and respecting the opposition. Like there's so many like micro little philosophies in sport that you learn. Yeah, it's kind of like a warrior code, especially with rugby. They say it's a gentleman's sport, but it's much more hardcore than soccer, you know, where soccer is kind of like very calmer, but you see the guys going on like hooligans sometimes. So it's those opposite ends of the of the same rope, I guess.
Well, you did say it was a blessing in disguise that injury came along, because it led you to what now is a very long acting career. And you also said at the start, Johan, that I was bigging you up. But to be honest with you, mate, I don't believe that to be the case at all. Because when I read through what you were up to during your time in South Africa from, it was 2002 to 2015, I was blown away. And that's no word of a lie, mate. It was the speed of what was happening during that period and the volume of work that you were getting through that struck me most. It felt like that you were on a high-speed roller coaster for those 13 years from the age of 15. So can you please tell us a little bit about the journey of your first acting role in the highly successful nationwide production of, and listen, I'm going to try and pronounce this in Afrikaans. It was Ande Kandiat. How is my Afrikaans?
Yeah, that's fine. Well done, Irishman.
Thank you very much.
What happened, long story short, is like, so I got the injury, and then there was an audition for a really cool play that was written by a man called André Bester, who was an amazing writer, director, and teacher and mentor and he had auditions, and this play was basically based on his life, and it was a hardcore story for teenage kids or boys to deal with at that time, because it had all the elements of sexual identity, insecurity, abuse, alcoholism, parents, the mother who passed away, independence, like all these kind of like big themes in life that we all dealt with. And just to correct you, the name is Anakan Diyar, which means pretty much on the other side of the yard or the other side of the fence, kind of peeking into someone's backyard, because the setting was in a backyard of a broken home, basically, with three brothers. Every brother had his own little journey. So yeah, I went for this audition, and the character I went for was a rugby player. So easily enough, I could identify with that aspect, but there were other aspects of the character that was quite far above my intellectual capacity at that time, and my maturity, my emotional maturity and things like that. So it was really hard for me to kind of do that audition. But what happened in this audition was really interesting. I was so depressed at that time of my life. I started crying at a certain point when they interviewed me. And I just talked about how whenever I try to achieve something, it feels like this gigantic obstacle just falls in my way. Like I was working my butt off to become the best sportsman possible. And then I got this injury, and suddenly my best friends didn't even talk to me again because I had no worth. I had no identity, you know. Then I worked my butt off to kind of like get back at school and get my academics to a certain place, and then I got yellow jaundice and I got this disease, and that got taken away from me. And whenever I did achieve something, people would say, yeah, it's because you're privileged or you're lucky, you know, like you never get the benefit of the doubt. You know, life is not nice and people are not gonna give you that. So it's fine. So that's something I learned really easy or earlier on in life. And then with this play, I got this role, I think, because if I was happy, I wouldn't get the role. I was pretty depressed at that time. And I think the director knew that there were elements there that he could work with, because I did have a background in what we call I Stay Fit, which is like oral competitions with prose, poetry, and things like that. I was lucky that my mother introduced me to the world of literature, which I still love till this day. So yeah, and then we got the play. We did 39 performances in a matter of 2 years in South Africa. And that introduced me to the world of theater and the industry in South Africa, which is not big at all. Everybody knows each other. Then I was like, well, that's what I'm going to do, because sport is performance, and you know, acting is performance. I like performing. I like pushing myself to places where I could be like, wow, like, cool, man, that's great. I don't like this idea of just being comfortable and going through life, like, I don't know, like, it just makes me, it excites me to get my blood rushing and my adrenaline up when I do something like that, like performance. And I love to show people, you know, like, you want to make the world better in a way, and you feel like you're following a bigger purpose or you've got more meaning to your life when you play characters like that and you do it sincerely and honestly. Because you have to be authentic. And there was a lot of pressure on us, because the director, I mean, it was his story. It was a story of his life, and it was a really hardcore story. And for us as 15, 14-year-old boys playing characters 5 years older than us, we had to do a lot of emotional growth in a very short while, and we had to understand concepts and problems in life that we didn't always consider. But I think all three of us had like elements of depth to our real lives, so we could associate with some of those topics and themes. We did win awards. We did get all the, you know, newspaper articles and stuff like that. So as teenage boys, we also became a little bit arrogant, to be honest. Obviously, like, you become like this little pseudo celebrity, and you know, so those things go to your head. And then when you take that away, we all know what happens to child stars. You know, most of the time they kind of lose the plot, because it's just too much too fast and they don't know how to manage it. You know, luckily now these days they manage young artists better because they know about the dangers. But in a place like South Africa, you don't have that kind of support. Like, it's every man for himself. Like, there's no like guidance in that field. More people will tell you what to do, but they won't show you what to do. People don't, you know, like that type of thing. Like, we live in a world now where where teaching is a bit more by leading by example, where it used to be, I tell you, I don't show you, and you got to figure it out. But luckily, that play did help with a lot of things we didn't understand at that time. Things like empathy, as a general footnote, for actors, like, just to understand that some people have it hard, you know. And that was kind of the gist of the play, was like, right next to you, a few hundred meters from you, whatever, like, people are struggling a lot. And in South Africa, that's also got the connotation with the inequality that we got brought up in, you know, like, over here, someone's sipping on $1,000 champagne, and right over there, somebody's just, you know, looking for scraps out of a dustbin to survive.
You know, Johan, when I listened to you speak with Connor Kelly on the Comeback podcast recently, and I really encourage people to go and listen to that episode because it's brilliant. One of the questions that I had during it was simply, how does a 15-year-old boy like yourself lead a normal life when he's been traveling across the country? It was nearly 2 years putting on those huge performances, experiencing the obvious highs that comes with performing. Now, I imagine there must have been a serious come down afterwards, Johan. How did you deal with that?
To be honest with you, I actually rejected all the memories from that time in my life for a whole while until I finally made peace with my past. I was in severe depression at that time. I didn't know this until years later when I became a teacher and I was like, oh my gosh, this is what I was dealing with. I had no idea. Yeah, it's hard, man. Like, it's a boys-only school. There are so many elements to the story, but it was a boys-only school. I was dealing with depression. I was failing miserably at maths and things. You know, I wasn't doing well academically. I had this operation. I had this disease called yellow jaundice for a while. And basically my whole identity, all the ideas that I had for my future went down the drain in a matter of 2 years. And I became something I had no idea about, which was this theater actor that got involved with like an extremist Christian church at that time, because I guess I was really susceptible to whatever hope was out there. And also very arrogant and selfish. Like, it's almost like I was on all the bad sides of bad. And I'm still battling elements of that until this day in terms of, you know, what it did to my self-reflection or even with my behavior or relationships to other people, because it's also complicated and hard to understand sometimes. And I changed schools. I changed schools a year later when we were done with the play. I was so over everyone. And my friend and I, Greg, he's a really great actor. He's gone on to Hollywood now. He also started with that play as a professional actor or semi-professional actor. And we're still friends today. But we kind of went our separate ways. I went to Paul Ruiz, which is a great school. And and then I just relaxed. And I was just like, you know what? I don't want to feel that pressure ever again. I just want to live my life. So then I started drinking a lot. Like, I was 16 years old. I was going out in Stellenbosch, which is a university town. And I started partying. And I was, just going out there enjoying my life and not really giving a damn. I skipped school a lot to the point where my father said to me, listen, either you pay your own school fees or you drop out, but I'm not doing it anymore. So I had to make a choice, and I was like, well, I guess I'll have to pay for it myself then. So I just became a bartender at the places that I was drinking at. And I was still underage, obviously, but I got away with it because of my facial hair. Yeah, and then that was kind of my high school years. Luckily, I bounced back from that. I just made so many transitions. And it felt like I was going from 14-year-old to 25-year-old in a matter of months or years. You know, like, yeah, I felt super misunderstood. I guess everybody who goes through teenage angst feels like that. But I had a little bit of everything in there, you know, substance abuse, isolation, emotional trauma, confusion, religious indoctrination and dogma, fundamentalist beliefs, you know, narcissism, a little bit of everything. And it all came in a matter of 4 years. So I really didn't enjoy my high school years. I did not enjoy it, to be honest. I did not enjoy my youth. I tried my best, but also that whole thing about you're not allowed to feel sorry for yourself, you know, like, how dare you feel, you know, sorry for yourself because you're so privileged, because you're able to go to these schools, because, you know, there are other people having it way worse, you know, that doesn't help. You know, like, it's crazy that people can say that to someone, like, you are not deserved of empathy or sympathy because, some people have it harder. It's such, I think that's absolute bullshit, man. when somebody, I don't care who you are, when somebody goes through pain, they are going through pain. They don't need to justify it. Nobody wants to go through pain. Nobody wants to look like they're going through pain. Nobody wants to act like they're going through pain. And that's counterintuitive to your healing process. You have to accept it. And if you're really a friend of someone and you want to be there for them, accept it with them and make peace with it and then work from there. But the last thing you should tell someone when they're dealing with stuff is you don't need to feel like that, you know? Like this whole idea that you have to feel, now on top of your depression, you have to feel guilty about it too, you know? It's like a double up. People need to become more understanding and forgiving and compassionate, man, because everybody deals with things. Doesn't matter which class you come from or what type of idea people have about you. Pain is pain. And Albert E. Frankel states it beautifully in his book, Man's Search for Meaning. People always reference Man's Search for Meaning. It's an amazing book. So yeah, so I mean, high school, I won't say it was the best, but on the silver lining part was that with all those hard times, you learn so much. And I learned a lot. I learned a lot by working in the service industry. I learned a lot by being a bartender, an actor. Man, I learned a lot about humans in general. Like, it's almost like your perspective and your intuitive nature when it comes to human connection just expands beyond unreasonable levels. Because I was kind of mingling with all these theater purists on the one side who were very interesting people, and all of them are smart and, you know, like very worldly. And then sometimes I was doing bartendering, so I was also mixing with like super alcoholics, being the bartender, the ear, you know, listening to their stories. So you just kind of get a bit of everything. And that actually made me, yeah, I just got so socially tired of that. And I think I've always been a bit of an introvert, but that especially made me a bit more reclusive because, yeah, it just became so intense. I think sometimes the world becomes so intense, you know, you're dealing with something that bothers you, and then suddenly you realize there's so much pain and stuff around you, and you have to, that's when you have to keep a clear head. You have to try and keep a clear mind and keep healthy and do whatever you can to just stay sane, because if you allow that negativity to penetrate your subconscious, then you've got a problem, friend. You know, you've got to find a way to kind of be proactive. And there are so many different ways. And that also kind of leads to unhealthy ways sometimes. Like some people work it away, you know, they become workaholics. So they just overwork themselves and just, you know, it's kind of like a form of running away from your problems. And then there are people who obviously take the addiction route, or people who, you know, like for me, I became a gamer. Like I love games, but gaming can be just as harmful as a meth addiction or anything else, because you would be sitting for hours without going to the, you know, to the bathroom before you realize like you've got a real life to live, and your RPG character, he's living higher standards than you are, you know, like, so yeah, man, by the end of my high school and the beginning of my university, I was really lucky to get into uni too, because I didn't have good marks. So I was lucky to go study drama, man. Like, and I was so happy to go study drama. The way I was thinking about life back then, I would have failed anything else. And I didn't do well in my academics and drama at all. I was really low. Practically, I was doing pretty well, but theoretically and academically, I was still like, it was hard for me to get up in the morning. Got involved with friends who, you know, everybody smokes a joint here and there. And then the next thing you know, you're smoking 24/7. And that one thing leads to the next, and all the gateways open up. And the next thing you know, you become like fucking train spotting, you know, like you find yourself in train spotting. And you're like, and then one day you have a little epiphany and you're like, how did I end up here? How did I go from little, you know, small town sporty guy who liked running barefoot, being innocent and happy about life, unaware of all this deep, crazy stuff, to being this semi-anorexic, like, weak, you know, drug abuser in this dark little, you know, apartment? Now, that's not necessarily entirely how it happened. It's just that's how quickly things can change, you know. And with, I'm saying quickly, but like 5 years, you know, look how much has happened since 2020. Look how much has changed with people's lives, how drastically things have changed globally. Like people's relationships, people's way of doing things has changed since 2020. We're not even done with 2021. It's insane. And it was the same for me at that time. It just felt like, you know, life is just moving too quick for me. I just Can I just get a chance to kind of sit still and be like, okay, what is what? What is what and where, what should I do? You know, I never had that opportunity. And I think when I moved to Vietnam, I kind of created it for myself. Moving to Da Nang was the first time, by the age of 30, it was the first time that I was actually clean of anything, not caffeine, not nicotine, not meat, you know, toxic people, going out drinking every night, or when I could, like, everything just revolves around all these kind of toxic aspects, you know, when people think about enjoying life or letting go. So I decided, well, let's give the other side a try. You know, look at all these people waking up at 5 a.m. in the morning. Are they crazy? There must be something there. And then when you go into that knowledge, you go into that wisdom, and you go look at how do I live a life I should be living? How can I get through this stuff? How can I get through this fleeting life as good as possible and positively as possible? And I wish there was, like, you know, I wish this was an education where they tell you why people wake up at 5. Oh, because it's got a neurological effect on you. The light literally has a positive effect on you, you know? So you start doing that kind of research, you start looking at all the, you know, positive things, and you just, you have to create that time for yourself, because at the end of the day, when you find something that works for you, or you break your addiction, or you come out the other side stronger, you also got to figure out why did you do it? Because a lot of people get there, but they don't know why. So then you get to your next stage of your battle. What's your meaning and your purpose? What can you do that's meaningful in your purpose? Like, obviously, we all know that happiness lies in serving other people. Well, not everybody knows that, but I mean, that's the fundamental law, in my opinion. You get what you give, and you want to be relevant, and you don't have to feel like, oh, you're just doing this to make yourself feel better about yourself. You're doing this because, well, that's how life has always worked. Like, creativity is just as important as physical exercise. Meditation, breathing, and yoga, they're all important. Forget about the names and the connotations and the meanings or the cultural perspective. They are things that your body needs to do in able to be 100%, to perform at the rate you want it to perform. And then obviously sleeping, you know, your sleeping pattern. So all these things I started doing, and then I was like, well, I'm in Da Nang now. What can I do in this community to kind of, you know, keep me away from all the troubles and rather be more proactive? So I was lucky enough to kind of, you know, make a plan and decided I want to teach communication, drama, acting. I want to take all those elements and combine that with education and give the kids a good time, but also make them learn some valuable lessons. And I was lucky enough to find Moon Art Performance Art Academy, Hang Nguyen, who invested in me. And she's the one who's helping me with my TRC and staying legal in Vietnam. So then I had the pressure off of me of doing a hardcore job to stay legal. And I had all this time for myself, and I was doing what I love. So I was like, well, you've got all this time. You can either become one of these guys who just walk around and drink and smoke joints every day like you did in uni, or you can try something else for a change and actually try to be some worth to someone, you know, other than yourself. And that's when I think I started being more proactive in Da Nang and started putting up all the projects and stuff like that. But then you face new challenges again, you know, like the moment you start doing things, you open yourself up for criticism, you open yourself up for judgment, and people don't always want other people to succeed for some reason, you know, and then you have to kind of like battle your way through that. And that comes with a whole new bag of lessons and things, you know, and relationships, and, you know, managing your relationships to people is a really tricky thing. You never know what's going to happen. You know, people can flip a 180 on you any day. But to be fair, you have also done that with yourself. You know, you can all, the next day you might just feel so miserable and, you know, without motivation that it's scary sometimes, you know. This is the thing, like, you got to find what works for you. If meditation doesn't work for you, maybe Zumba works for you, you know, or surfing or whatever. But there needs to be something that just helps you to calm down and come back to your core and who you are as a person, and realize that we all are the same in that aspect. You know, we're all just trying to make sense of reality. We're all just trying to get out of this as good as possible without hurting other people or hurting ourselves. And what's the opposite of that? do things for other people, heal other people, and heal yourself. Or forgive, forgiveness, understanding, all those things, man. It's the hardest things to wrap your head around, because practically they're so hard to do, especially within those moments where you get caught off guard or in traffic when, you know, somebody cuts you off in Vietnam, which happens every 5 minutes. And like, I've realized I can measure my spiritual growth or my patient growth on how long it takes me to react or how many times I react to that. So yeah, man, like, nobody's ever without mistakes. I still screw up a lot in my relationships with people. I still say things that are wrong, you know, even though I teach communication, so it's kind of ironic. And I can promise you there's a lot of psychologists and neurologists and all these like experts out there that have the same issues. It's challenges that come around in circles. And every time you go through one, you just have to make a mental note of it or an actual note of it in your journal and be like, well, next time I got to remember how to handle this one. So yeah, sorry, that's super long that I just went on a tangent there, but I guess that's what podcasts are about.
You went from 0 to 100 there and then on to 1,000, my friend.
I took your role away, you know, it's my show now.
Actually, the role of the host is to keep quiet and let the other person talking. And it was in rehab that I learned that. Before I went to rehab, Johan, all I wanted to do when I was recording a podcast was basically hug the show. And when I went to rehab, I realized that I learn a lot more from the guests by actually listening to them. So I was more than happy to hear what you had to say there. There's some amazing stuff in there, absolutely fascinating. And one of the things that really stood out for me was, I don't know if you remember this, one day after The Art of Living, both of us went for we went for a night date together, a lunch date, so to speak. You invited me down to a restaurant and you said the cauliflower is fantastic. And I thought to myself in my head, the Springbok is inviting me down to a restaurant for a cauliflower. No wonder he didn't make the rugby team. So anyway, we went down and we had the cauliflower. I can't stand cauliflower. And anyway, it was crap, as I expected. And we had a fantastic conversation. Yeah. It was wonderful. But you did mention anger to me in that conversation. You said anger, that's the thing that I really struggled to deal with. And what's really fascinating for me, Johan, is that about 4 years ago, well, maybe 5 years ago, I suffered a really bad back injury myself when I was in China, and it was alcohol related. I fell or something coming home one night, and I had to stop everything I wanted to do, everything I enjoyed doing, squash, badminton, tennis, jogging. And the back injury, it drove me absolutely crazy. Like, I believed it was driving me out of my mind. And the anger that came from that, like, it drove me to, like, a lot more drinking. It drove me to a lot more drugs. And I wonder how much of your anger stemmed from that injury.
Oh, 100%, because like, as a rugby player, it's very physical, and it's obviously you get a lot of your frustration out. I think that's the core of anger, is frustration. I don't think anybody wants to be angry. It's frustration, man. It's when you feel powerless and you go on the defensive mode, because anger triggers all the same things that, you know, it would trigger if you had to defend yourself as a caveman. You know, if the saber-toothed tiger came pouncing towards you, you would like, You either you're going to play the prey and back up in the corner, or you're going to growl back at it and be like, all right, well, if I'm going to go down, I'm going to go down fighting. You know, that's what anger is. But obviously Buddha said, you'll not be punished for your anger. You'll be punished by your anger. In what subtle ways are you punished by your anger each day? You know, and anger is that punishment we deal to ourselves. I guess everybody knows about that quote. Or people would say anger is punishing yourself for someone else's mistakes. And in The Art of Living, we learn that there is no intention behind people's mistakes. People make mistakes, you know. So anger is also such an unfair thing, because there's no rationality behind it. And for me, I come out of a society where, well, not a society, but I'm maybe an environment where you didn't always know if you're dealing with anger, sternness, or just militant, you know, behavior. You know, like in education, there's that whole thing about, you know, discipline is helping a child to solve a problem. Punishment is making a child suffer for having a problem. And to raise problem solvers focuses on solutions, not retribution, if you get what I'm saying. I think that's a NOSC quote. For me personally, it's a hard one, because I get frustrated. I'm a passionate person, first of all. I'm an expressive person. So when I get agitated, I get louder, you know, and being a bigger guy, like I get really loud, and being, you know, using my voice like that to come across. And I do have this tendency to become super extreme about certain things I really feel is important. You know, sometimes people feel for some reason they have to impose their way of seeing things onto each other. And once you start feeling like that, once you start feeling fiery, or how do you say, yeah, once you start feeling feverish about being right, you've already lost, my friend. Because it's not about being right, it's about being kind. You know, if you had to choose between the two, I think most people will choose being kind. Unfortunately, they're not aware enough, they want to be right. And also it's because that's pretty much when people look at ideology and fundamental beliefs, some people would say, this is what I believe, this is strong, and whoever disagrees with me, you know, to hell with them. And then if you find a place within that argument they're making, and you say, well, there's a mistake there, people will get hurt if you carry on this way. They will be like, well, that's just collateral damage, right? So that leads to like the topic of narcissism, for instance. Like, that word gets thrown around a lot today, especially in relationships. I think arrogance and narcissism, you know, if people act that way without backing it up, that's the roughest way. If people are saying things or talking highly of themselves or being, you know, selfish in a way, at least they should back it up. You know what I mean? So I don't know. There's so many ways of looking at that. Anger was one that I think the frustration from, just the frustration, you know, because being raised a Christian, you always have to be thankful to God for all your blessings. But why aren't you allowed to be angry and pissed off with him? You know, hey, man, you're God, right? Can't you just, you know, do the Thanos click and make everything right again? You know, like, what's up with that? So that was a big thing with me. I had these conversations with God, and going through that whole religious experience, that extremism religion. I read the Bible twice in 1 year. It's absolutely insane. I almost got kicked out of the school because of fanaticism, basically. I tried to actually, convert the whole hostel I was a monitor of to Christians, like all this crazy stuff. And then obviously the inside battle too. And I guess I want to get to the point where my anger personally, or anger in general, is such a sad reaction that we have when we feel like we have to defend ourselves from something that doesn't really affect us. We allow it to affect us by being angry at it.
Johan, I want to talk to you about your career in South Africa up to 2015, because it would take a podcast alone to name out all the different events and activities you were involved with within the entertainment industry in South Africa. And I'm just wondering why you left that all behind in 2015 to come to Vietnam.
Life is short, Eugene. I think at that stage, listen, just to get this out of the way, for all of those who knew me at that time, it's not like I've achieved all this amazing feats, you know. It's not like I broke the barrier of relevance in terms of the entertainment industry in South Africa. Not at all, not by a long shot. In fact, I was I was all over the show, and I was not always doing well. I was sometimes making a mess of things tremendously. So just to get that out of the way, it wasn't like I was some sort of golden boy in any sense. I screwed up a lot. So my mother and I, we had a theater. We started a theater right after I studied drama, and my mother was running this kind of cabaret theater, and I joined her eventually after getting my degree in drama. So we did a lot of acting and projects, and obviously you kind of do a little bit of everything when you do a theater. It was in Stellenbosch. It was called Underbrock Theater. Don't try and pronounce that one, Eugene. And it was great. So the whole theater's purpose was to be a platform for young artists who can't afford all the other theaters, that forces you to put down a deposit of money you don't have to do a performance, you know. And we kind of wanted to be like a non-profitable theater in that way, where we kind of help artists to just give them a stage or give them a platform to begin from. So we did produce some things, and my mother did an amazing job. There are some artists back in South Africa that I think owes her an amazing thanks. And at that time, I was working so much on the theater and more on other people's careers that I wasn't even thinking about my own. So eventually, by the time I got a bit of a break and I got like some ads here and some things there, it was kind of a little bit too late. I wasn't very focused. And I think I wasn't focused because I wasn't happy. I was doing what I love, but I couldn't love what I was doing because I was not happy. And the reason I wasn't happy was because I felt everything was way too scripted. And I thought everything was way too predictable. Even if I made it as an actor or some sort of entertainment personality in South Africa, at that stage, I knew exactly how that story would end. I knew exactly what the limits are in that industry at that point. And to be honest with you, it's not the same as anywhere. It's not like America, you know. It's not like you become this red carpet, you know, celebrity living in a $1 million mansion or whatever. It's not like that. It's South Africa. It's a third world country. And a lot of people live a first world life in South Africa. Or let's put it like this. People believe they live a first world life under the mentality. They have first world mentalities in a third world country. That's why there's so much inequality. Like people don't, you know, they don't really deal with the reality of where they are. And in that industry specifically, it's really tough. And you really get confronted with it because the moment there's an economic collapse, you feel it in the arts. You don't get funding for projects and things like that. So even though it was going okay with me, I guess I had some sort of future. I mean, it could have been better. I didn't really feel like I was losing anything by leaving. I was like, no, dude, you need to get out there and get maturity under your belt and go see the world. And, you know, like I felt like I was 28, so I had 2 years of my 20s left, and I spent 16 years in Stellenbosch. That's way too long for one place where your parents live, you know. It was just so comfortable. So I had to make a move. And Cape Town was not any better because it was pretty much just like Stellenbosch upgraded. So I was like, okay, let's go. Let's go check out what's on the other side of the unknown. Best thing I did for myself ever, stripped myself of everything and started over.
Well, it's interesting that you use the word mature, because on my sheet in front of me here, I wrote down earlier about Johan, molded in South Africa, matured in Vietnam. And then now is it time to go back to South Africa to make it in 2021, because I feel that you're at a crossroads again in your life, similar to where you were at in 2015. And
damn right there. I think everyone is.
I think you're very conflicted over whether you should go back to South Africa, because you did say in the last podcast, I was listening to it, I am an actor, I am a performer. If I could be anything, I would be an actor and only an actor. And you have a huge opportunity for that now coming up in the new year. And I think that is really bringing some conflict to your mind, because you love your life here in Vietnam. And is there an element of fear to go back into that world that you've left behind?
You can go listen to any actor's story. There is never a moment of security unless they become secure within themselves. You know, one great actor who always has this amazing stories and tales to tell is Matthew McConaughey, and I really recommend people go listen to his stories or even read his book, because yeah, he's a wildcat when it comes to that, but he's really inspirational. Yeah, no, you're right, Eugene. It's such an uncertain time in the world. Like, nobody knows what's going to happen next. I carved out exactly what I wanted to do, or how I wanted to live life in Da Nang. It took me a few years, but I've come to a point where everything that I have, that I own, which is not much, is fine. And where I live and how I live is perfect. I can do this until the day I die, and I'll be happy. I'm very happy and content right now. But then all of this came along and kind of pulled out the rug to know your feet. And the next thing you know, you're not even allowed to go do your own shopping. Now, I know that's just temporary, right? And I think that's just a lesson. Everything is temporary. I mean, I went through a breakup right before lockdown started. Ah, man. And that one just came out of nowhere. And, you know, you feel so betrayed and you feel so alone because your best friend of, you know, it's like losing a limb just kind of disappeared. And then you have to pick yourself up and find some self-worth again and find some rationality in what happened. You know, like, how do you make sense of all this, of this world around you just crashing down? And it's okay. You get to a point where you have to get to that acceptance point. Allow yourself to feel the frustration and all the things, deal with it, find a way to manage it, and start looking forward and going, okay, it's temporary, it's going to pass, what's the next step? Not your first rodeo, right? You've been through this. So here I am again. Yeah, I got this great opportunity from a mate of mine. I'm not allowed, really. I don't think I should be talking about it publicly, because in that industry, nothing is set in stone. Things can easily fall away, and it's not a good idea to talk about it publicly at all. And it's also not always a good idea to talk about your next move, you know? Even though I said if I could be an actor, I'd only be an actor. Yes, that's true, but I can't help but mention the fact that I get so much meaning and purpose out of education. I like education, and it's weird because I grew up hating education. And now, once I cleared my head and kind of like went through this kind of like a rebirth, now I love knowledge, wisdom, you know. I love finding out about things. I love researching things, talking about things, philosophizing about things. So I might just go back into an academic career after this, not only because I love it, but love learning, but also because it would obviously increase my range for work. And I like working with people. I like doing things like this. You know, I like talking to people. I like sharing what I've experienced. And I like learning from what others have experienced, because like I said, I think at the end of the day, it's all about us trying to make sense of reality or this life we're living. What does it all mean? Where is your meaning and purpose? And how can we help each other to find that? Because I think as sooner as everyone finds their meaning and purpose, the sooner things might get better.
Do you know who Terry Malloy is?
Sounds familiar, but no idea.
Marlon Brando on the waterfront. I could have been a contender. He had a big opportunity and he threw the fight, and he regretted it a lot afterwards. And I wondered, will you regret it if you don't go back to South Africa and take this wonderful opportunity that may come your way?
I have to take this opportunity because that's what I was supposed to be. And for me, life is all about synchronicities. You know, sometimes things happen that you didn't plan for. And that's life, man. You know, we're all, it's not going to end the way, you know, it ends in fairy tales and movies. We all know how it's going to end. Let's be honest here. It's not going to, like, it's not going to end with you drifting up on a cloud or anything like that. It's probably going to end super alone and dark and sad and maybe even confusing. So for me, how can you get to that point in your life the most exciting way possible? And it's hard to talk about it now, and it's hard to talk about it publicly, you know, because I don't really know, Yuji. I have no idea. But put it like this, I'm open to what the world throws at me. And because that's the kind of mentality I had when I came over here, and it surprised me pleasantly, you know. It, like synchronicity, sometimes you just sit in a moment and you'd be like, man, I've been through hell, and then suddenly you'd be like, it's going to be okay. You just have these moments, you know, where it's like, oh, it's going to be okay. We had, you know, like that whole thing about the bird going out of the tree and being like, I don't want to jump because what if I fall? And then the mother bird goes, but what if you fly? You know, so we got a risk. Life is a risk. It's a risk to live. I just wish they would allow us to risk. Because without risk, there is no life. But right now, I can't even go do shopping, so I don't have any option. I don't have any say in the matter. But yeah, I love Da Nang. I love the community here. But when I talk about that, to be honest, we are talking in past tense. I think we're all aware of things changing pretty drastically at the moment, and that's why it's hard to talk about it. Because right now, nobody knows what's going on and where it's heading towards. I don't blame people for leaving a bit. Maybe things will get better in the future, you know. I mean, I'm lucky enough to make a lot of my income from voiceovers. So if I have to leave and do that from home for a while, that's fine. Even though everyone who goes back home, everyone's a little bit miserable. But it's only because we had such a good time over here. You know, like Vietnam is an amazing place. People shouldn't forget how much they benefited from it, you know, just because it's not that great right now, because it could be there again. So yeah, man, the give and takes of life and how we deal with it. Well, allow yourself to feel frustrated for a moment, but then you have to accept it, because if you don't accept it, you're not going to move on. So you accept what has happened to you, all the breakups, all the people, everything people said, all the fights you had, all the mistakes you made. Accept it, forgive them, forgive yourself, trust that love is the answer and love is your guiding force, and open your heart, open your mind, and take the leap of faith and see what happens, because life's a journey, not a destination.
It's interesting. This morning, I was listening to your podcast with Connor Kelly for, I think it was the third time I was listening to it. And towards the end, when you were talking about that possible move back to South Africa, but in the next breath, you were talking about how much you love it here in Da Nang. And I said to myself, Johan is in pre-mourning. And then I said to myself, is there such a thing as pre-mourning? And I went home and I Googled it, and it said, yes, it's anticipating grief in the future. I couldn't believe it. And I sort of sensed to myself, that's maybe where you were at in relation to a possible move in the future. But I will leave that element there for you to think about. I want to talk to you before we go a little bit about acting and actors, because you said acting is about unbecoming who you are, to be able to become what you are not, but to do that convincingly. You said it's literally to put yourself in someone else's shoes. So what I was wondering was, what kind of qualities and skills does a person need to be able to pull that off successfully? Could you maybe give us an example of a couple of actors and actresses who you believe do that?
Okay, so yes, that's exactly what that means. The unbecoming is working on the skills, and I'll go into that now, but first I want to just set something straight, because somebody criticized me for saying literally putting yourself in someone else's shoes. Obviously, that's figuratively, but because we're actors, you think of it in a literal way of becoming the character, you know, not in a method acting type of style, but more in a, like, when you're on screen, and or when you're doing your performance, you are that character. Like, literally, you are the character, right? You're just figuratively putting yourself in someone else's shoes. So I just wanted to set straight a friend of mine who had like a pet peeve with people using literally when it's figuratively. So the unbecoming of an actor has got to do exactly like what we talked about skills, right? So as an actor, you have a bunch of exercises you can do daily. So the workshops I've done, like, it's all based on the neutral body, which a lot of therapy is based on too, you know. Where is your natural center when it comes to everything? Where is your natural place? You know, the most of the times when you meditate, you kind of mentally, or you get to that place. Or when you stretch enough, your body feels balanced. Or when you breathe the right way, your breath is balanced and not dictated by your emotions. You know, and the same with exercise. If you do weight training, you have to stretch it out at some point just to get that balance. So, and with acting, it's the same. That's the unbecoming I'm talking about, because we are a bunch of habits and identities placed on us by external forces that we adopted along the way without knowing it. All our subconscious, like, traits and habits are not things that we chose for ourselves. We didn't choose our names, our identities, our cultures. We didn't choose our habits. It's because we grew up in a certain... You don't like drinking beer because you chose it. It's because that's what people did around you, and naturally you started doing the same thing. You know, things like that, or the way you speak, your accent, you know? So unbecoming is all about getting to a neutral part where you have a quite a neutral accent, or you're able to go from who you are to a clean canvas, and then whatever the job is, to become the new canvas, right? And then you take, then you become a new character by putting these new habits and these new traits and cultural identity and stuff and accent or whatever. You put that on the canvas to make a new painting, and then obviously the trick is again to take that away, go back to the neutral phase, and when you go out to have a good time or on holiday, you go back to yourself, right? So that's called the restored order. So there are all these themes and things you learn in acting or in drama studies that a lot of times are overlooked, because people always, when they just assume when you go study drama or acting, oh, you want to become an actor. But there's a lot of psychology, philosophy, and a little bit sociology in there, all together wrapped under literature and, you know, like, basically some of the best life lessons you'd ever learn in terms of morality. So I find it very admirable for people to take on that life. You know, I look at the best actors as monks, almost, people who are severely disciplined, and who know themselves very well, to the point where, you know, they can change themselves, because you have to know yourself and then you have to go study someone else. I've played basically played every toxic male you can possibly imagine. You know, I've played the abuser, I've played the Nazi, I've played the, you know, the, like I said, my first role was a high school jock who was basically a bully, and his name was Nick, who's like them, like Saint Nick, you know, whatever. So there's all these elements. So that when it comes to an actor that I look, it's hard for me to pinpoint one actor when people ask me who's my favorite actor, or who's a great example of this, but I would always say Robin Williams, because Robin Williams went from nice, relaxed, friendly guy to this way out character that's so sharp, you know. And Robin Williams, the type of films he did was also so inspiring, you know. Like he was just such a sweetheart, and I think he was really a guy like that. Like being a stand-up comedian too, he was just, you could just see it, man. He was such a soft soul, and it's sad the way he went. It's sad the way he left us, you know. And so many actors go through that, because I think they are people who understand things to a point where it's almost heartbreaking to accept that as our reality. But you can get through that. And the way you get through that is by, like I said, accepting it and using it to your advantage. I think some people go a bit far down the rabbit hole sometimes, but can't manage people's journey. People have to manage themselves. So you have to learn how to manage yourself as an actor. Otherwise, you can get carried away on either sides of that spectrum, on the imaginative side, but also the kind of lifestyle side.
You've been incredibly difficult on yourself today, Johan, and flogged yourself a couple of times about your achievements over the course of your career. Incredibly tough on yourself. So I'm nearly afraid to ask you what your proudest professional achievement is.
Well, before I left South Africa, I did a one-man cabaret show called Mach, which translates to power, but also the word might, which means like, what are we allowed to do and what are we not allowed to do? If I did that play today, I think it would be very relevant, because that was what it was about all these, you know, like how society and all these like systematic laws and, you know, this idea about patriarchy and all this stupid, like all these ideas that pop up on social media and memes these days and people's damn, like, you know, one narrow-minded point of views or stuff like that, where people try to make a statement, like all of that was in there. And I just did that show because I loved it. I did that show because I wanted to do something for myself. And I did this little cabaret, and it was like, it wasn't a big deal, but all the music was written for me by Andre Strijdom, who's a really cool rocker composer in South Africa. And it was all these kind of like almost anarchy type of music. So I objected to this whole idea that people, you know, that life has this these expectations of us. Anyway, I did this show, which I wrote myself. I directed it myself. Big mistake. You always need a director or a mentor or a guide. but then I think the biggest compliment I ever got was from a very big theater journalist who managed to come see the show, because there was only one show and 100 tickets. And she said to me, it's one of the best shows she's ever seen in her life. But she can't write anything about it in the newspaper, because she didn't plan to. There is nothing to write, because it's not about being a good show. It's about speaking the truth. And then one of my best friends, who's an English guy who doesn't watch Afrikaans theater, even though I did it in bilingual language, he said to me, well, he cried. Like, there's a lot of people who walked out of there in tears and, you know, who congratulated me. And some people didn't want to talk to me afterwards because I probably hit a nerve. That's what theater does, you know. But it wasn't the reaction that I necessarily were looking for, but it was a very big relief, because I got to say what I wanted to say. I had my turn to do art. I didn't win any awards. I didn't even scratch the surface of mainstream media or anyone, you know. Like, there's a big clique in South Africa that they don't acknowledge anyone else's art or anyone else's, you know, what do you call it, you know, efforts, basically. It's a very selfish industry back home, because there's not enough work for everyone. So people kind of tend to, you know, bundle up a bit and be very defensive about it. So I wasn't expecting anything like that. And I definitely didn't make the cut when it came to good productions. But for me, that was the biggest relief or release of my life, because I did something for myself. I did something which was authentic, sincere. And then afterwards, people who had no idea about theater told me that that was the best thing they've ever seen. And even a mainstream journalist told me that was brilliant, and only 100 people saw it and will ever see it, and I don't think I'll ever do it ever again.
Is there any particular reason why not?
I don't know, man. You need a lot of. It's a traumatic experience going through a one-man show, actually, especially if it's personal. You know, theater is one of the most powerful forces of getting ideas across out there. And especially if you're alone in the game, and you know, you've got all your friends and family there, and you're exposing your heart and soul and your thoughts, and how fragile you are, and how, you know, fallible you are to everyone, like literally. Then, yeah, man, that takes a lot of guts, but it's also very relieving. It's like bungee jumping, you know. So I think that was great. Yeah, I won't do it again because it's scary. It's scary. I might do it when I feel like it's something I've got something to say. But that day I got it off of my chest. That's why I only did one show. I just needed to get it off my chest. I rehearsed for a whole year, almost a year and a half, on one show just to do it once and never do it again.
Who has been the biggest influence on your life thus far? Apart from myself, that is, of course.
I think Andre Bester was a big influence on me, the guy who gave me that role when I was 15, and he passed away sadly last year. We are actually writing a script. We're trying to get a script together to honor his memory. He made a big influence on me, even though he wasn't always the most pleasant guy to be around with. He was an amazing creator and friend, you know. But then again, there are also people like my first personal trainer, Craig Norman in South Africa from Body Elite. He showed me what was possible physically. And then there was Barbara Barbieri who helped me with my voice. This is another thing that I wish we could talk about, but like the voice, the sound of your voice is the color of your soul. And I didn't know that my voice at that moment, at that time, was sounding so weird because actually I was sad. So she instead of giving me voice training, she did soul training and like life coaching with me. And then my voice started changing. How remarkable is that?
Wait a minute. Let's go back to that. I want to know more about that.
So I was kind of, okay. So I was going through a time where I didn't really get any roles, or I didn't like... people, like, I just felt like so powerless, like, and I went for a lead role in a film called Black Sails, which you can see on Netflix. It's a series about pirates, and I just couldn't hit the accent. I'm not really good with accents, and as you can hear, I've got a bit of a lisp. I've got some speech impediments that kind of hold me back sometimes, especially in my native language. That's why it's easier for me to do things in English. But then I went for the audition, and I couldn't hit this mid-Atlantean pirate accent for an American audience. That's what they were looking for. And I went to her and I said, listen, I think I need some speech training, because also being an MC and a public speaker, after a rock festival, sometimes my voice would be gone. Obviously, smoking and drinking didn't help. But yeah, like I had something was wrong with my voice. I couldn't sing the way I wanted to. I couldn't talk. And she sat me down and she was like, when I listen to you talk in your normal voice, you sound sad. Like, are you okay? You know? And she gave me a few things to read. And she's a really amazing speech therapist. People should check into speech therapy. It's amazing. I'm lucky enough to have had that experience because I've incorporated into education and what I do. But anyway, she kind of taught me about the psychological effects that our lives or our state of being have on our voices. People don't think about this. And what she basically said was something that was very profound. She just said to me, listen, the sound of your voice is the color of your soul. So if you know, like mood rings, if you know, if you're in a bad mood if it's a sad mood or something is bothering subconsciously, people pick those cues up subconsciously. We communicate in so many different ways. You know, people can hear the sadness in someone's voice when they speak. Or so even if you're an actor and you are acting as a character, but in your personal life you have problems that you're not able to hide away with your acting, then you're not bullshitting anyone, you know. And that's also about unbecoming yourself, unbecoming those things you feel in order to replace those small cues and ways of communicating with something else. Yeah, man, and it was such an interesting process because she started, she was like, what's your sleeping pattern like? Let's, before we work on your voice, we have to work on basic things like your posture and your way of thinking about yourself. Like, you look down when you walk. When you walk, where do you look? People look down, you should look up, look forward, you know, because it's sending you mental cues to look to the future, to pick up your chin. That really has some power to it, you know. All those type of things. And that's when I started going into the personal growth journey, really. Was first I got a personal trainer, then I got a speech therapist, and both of them kind of doubled up as life coaches. And that kind of, you know, paved the way forward for me.
Okay, Johan, listen, we're going to have to leave it there for today. I really want to thank you for coming on the podcast. You have been very hard on yourself at times, in my opinion. I remain a really big fan of your work. I think you have achieved an incredible amount both in South Africa and Vietnam, both professionally and personally, as I wrote on Facebook last night. I love what you do. I love the dedication, the commitment, and the passion you have for your work and the arts in general this last 19 years. I tell you what, it's not easy to keep going for that length of time in that industry, and that you have speaks volumes about what kind of man you are. And the story you just shared about that one-man play of yours is the perfect example of what I am saying, Johan. You're a very determined guy. You're a very talented guy. Listen, you're a wonderful guy. I love talking to you. Getting to know you since March has been fantastic, and I'm proud to call you my friend. My one parting piece of advice to you is not to be so hard on yourself, mate. Listen, there's plenty of people out there only too happy and ready to knock you. And all of us, to be honest with you. So, try to be a bit kinder to yourself, Johan. A little bit of self-compassion, a little bit of self-love is needed on the menu for you tonight, Mr. Falk. Thank you very much, Johan.
Yeah, yeah. No, you're 100%. I just want to reply to that. Like, yeah, don't love being with yourself. Love being yourself, you know. And but no, I know it can be hard on me, but I just wanted to give you the real transparent things, because sometimes in these podcasts, guys can make themselves sound like they know it all. You know, they've done it all. I don't want to bullshit anybody. I'm just like them. Like, I'm like anyone else, you know. Like, we're all the same in a way. We're all dealing with the same stuff. So, yeah. Thank you, Eugene, for the opportunity to share my heart with you. Big love, bro. You're an amazing man.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Johan Falk, raw and uncut, and being incredibly hard on himself, to be honest with you. Despite what the lad said, he has achieved a lot, both professionally and personally, this last 20 years. And as I said to him at the end of the show, he needs to be a little less hard on himself. I wish Johan the very best for the future, and I have no doubt that he has the potential and the talent to go right to the top if he wants to. I wish him well. As I mentioned at the start of the episode, this is my last planned podcast of the year. I'm going to take a short break and then I'm going to focus on writing for the foreseeable future. Now, whether I see out the year in Vietnam, that remains to be seen. It's certainly in my heart, this country, along with the Camino de Santiago in Spain, yet there appears to be a force drawing me to Mexico that I just can't explain. I've had an amazing time here the last 2 years, and I've met some truly inspirational people along the way, from Johan today to Quinn Hanneman, Ana Luisa to Kelsey Nicole, Mai McCann from Hearing and Beyond, Mother Mai of Hoi An is what I call her, and how could I forget the Prophet Jan Muhammad at the Windsor Tea House in Da Nang. And there was also the Polish ambassador Labovitz, who brought such positive energy and joy into everyone's life here in Vietnam. I'm so grateful to all these people and everyone in Vietnam. It was Charles Bukowski who said, "It's the lack of change that kills a man." I just have to figure out in my head, should I listen to the ramblings or the gospel according to that particular madman? Who knows? The final song is from my producer, the brilliant, multi-talented Curtis Goodwolf. I've been using Kurt on this podcast and on the last podcast with Kellen Flukiger, and I can tell you, I would highly recommend him to anybody. He is sensational. The song is a cover of Chris Cornell's Like a Stone. Stay safe, everybody. Stay positive and keep spreading peace, love and joy throughout the world. With Mr. Terrapod, you are not alone.
confess I was lost in the pages of a book full of death, reading how we'll die alone. If we're good, we're laid to rest anywhere we want to go. In your house, I long to be.